Yeah, I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:36 p.m. on Thursday, April 6th, 2017. Present today, we have Representative Ortiz, Pruitt, Wilson, Vice Chair Guerra, Co-Chair Seaton, Representative Tilton, Gren, Guttenberg, Thompson, and myself, Co-Chair Foster. And before we start, just a reminder, folks could mute their cell phones. And at this meeting, we will be hearing HB 47, which is Municipal PERS Contributions and Interest, HB 131, which is the Relocation Assistance for Federal Projects and Programs, HB 127, which is the Criminal Conviction Overturned, Received Past PFDs, and HB 141, which is the Alaska Workforce Investment Board and Funds. And it is my intention to have HB 47 and HB 131 introduced today and then move them through public testimony. And we will bring the bills back under bills previously heard. And it's also my intention to move HB 141 from the committee. So with that, our first bill up this afternoon is HB 47, Municipal PERS Contributions. And at this time, I will hand the gavel over to Representative Seaton, since it is my bill. And Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Representative Foster and LeBeau, would you please come up and present your bill? Do you want to be at the table? You're going to be at the table. Or are you up for Lois?
Okay.
And would you like to go ahead and put yourself on the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Paul LeBeau, staff to Representative Foster.
Representative Foster, House District 39.
And since you both know, we have two male voices that will say your name before starting conversations. So due to the fact that, let's see, so would you like to begin your presentation on House Bill 47? Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Paul LeBeau, staff to Representative Foster. House Bill 47 addresses an unintended consequence of previous legislation. Back in 2007, Senate Bill 125 addressed the problem with the PERS system by pooling all individual systems and bringing them together under one roof. When they did that, they put in what was known as the 08 floor, which is where you have to pay your gross receipts of 2008 or your gross salaries of the current year, whichever is greater. The basis of that floor was so that municipalities wouldn't lay off their workers and hire contract employees, thereby getting rid of their payment into the system with the existing liability still being there. What has come to pass for a few communities is that they've lost a considerable amount of their population, therefore some of their tax base, and have been unable to make the floor payment through no fault of their own. HB 47 corrects this in two ways. The first way is that it resets the 2008 floor to 2012, and the second thing is it allows delinquent interest rate to be negotiated by the administration. To qualify for this, you have to have lost 25% or more of your population between the 2000 and 2010 census. And with that, I'm available for questions.
Questions, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So this bill in no way opens up the PERS and TERS liability issue?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, depending on what you mean, it would slightly add to the unfunded liability, but there will be no future exposure as you have to qualify between censuses that have already passed.
Follow-up?
Representative Wilson.
So I didn't understand. So it's because they won't be giving as much contribution because they've decreased so much, And so although there may still be people that are in the PERS-inter situation that no longer works there, the state would still be liable for those payments if, when they retired. Is that where the money comes from?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, you're correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Paul, thank you for being here on this bill. Can you give me kind of like an example of a not a real community, but let's just say make-believe community, where under the current situation, what it puts that community in, where just give me a make-believe of how this actually works.
Okay.
How about that?
Okay. Let's say a fish processing plant closed in a village, and let's say the salaries for that city municipality were, well, let's say their 22% contribution rate of their gross salaries was $150,000, and their 2008 floor was $100,000. After the processing moved out, people moved away from town, they dropped their 22% of gross salaries down to $80,000. They're still statutorily required to pay the $100,000 floor. Now, if they can't pay that floor, but they are continuing to pay their gross salaries, then the remainder of that difference is a delinquent payment. And currently, delinquent payments are assessed a 12% interest rate by statute. And so that would keep accruing at 12% every year, every time this happens, and build quite a burden. And there's very little in the way of flexibility either for the administration or for a municipality to address this. The administration is required to collect the 08 floor or gross salaries, whichever is greater, and they're required to assess a 12% interest rate on delinquent payments. As far as the municipalities go, they cannot dissolve without resolving their debts. And if they could afford to resolve, you know, their debts, then they wouldn't be in the situation. And they are not able under state law to declare bankruptcy.
Okay. Representative Ortiz.
And so with the passage of this bill, it moves the floor up to a later date in time, which presumably would be a less burdensome floor for them to meet, because that population decrease hopefully took place sometime between the 2008 period and the 2012 period.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Ortiz, yes.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, Representative Foster, I just want to say that's a hypothetical situation, and we will have the city manager as well as the mayor of Galena online to describe a situation that did occur where the military base left the very small community of Galena, and so this is one situation where that would be, you know, an occurrence, and you know, through no fault of their own, the military base leaving there, I think is a pretty substantial change for the small community. So, but thank you.
Representative Grant.
Thank you, Co-Chair Seaton. Looking at the packet and the emails from Division Director of DRB, kind of lists the communities that have lost 25%. Is it so? We're just talking about these three communities: Galena, Pelican, and Atka.
Paula Bolst, after Representative Foster. Representative Grimm, through the chair. There are actually five communities that qualify. The three that you mentioned are the ones that are affected. I believe Atka is not on that list, but they're qualified. They are not on the list because they are actually currently paying above the floor and have been paying above the floor. So while they're qualified, it doesn't affect them. And Anderson had zero employees, and so adjusting their floor would take it from current zero to still zero.
Let me do the math on that. Okay, thank you.
Are there further questions? We do also have the Alaska Municipal League to testify, as well as for questions, we have Kevin Worley, CFO, Division of Retirement and Benefits, Department of Administration, online as well for the committee. So our, further questions on this? Yes, Representative Wilson.
So the gentleman on the for the retirement, so I just want to make sure I understand the fiscal note correctly. So we will actually have to write a check for the $129,000 for 2017 supplemental, and then another increase of $121,000 in 2018. Those are actual amounts, not just, you know, depending upon who retires when, but those will be monies that will have to be put in the retirement fund because of this bill.
And I believe that was for Kevin Worley.
Yeah.
Are you online? Oh, here.
Even better.
And if you put yourself on the record, and then if you heard the full question, or if not, we can have it repeated.
Thank you. If you could repeat the question, I couldn't quite hear it all the way.
Representative Wilson.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair, thank you. A lot of times we get estimates, so I just want to make sure that these, you know, whether these are estimates. So in the fiscal note, because it becomes effective immediately, it appears that we will owe an additional $129,000 for a 2017 supplemental contribution, and then then put into the budget for 2018 of $121,000. I just want to make sure that those are actuals, that's not, you know, potential liability that we don't have to account for right now.
Through the chair, Kevin Worley, Chief Financial Officer, DRB, Representative Wilson. These are estimates from our actuary. What they're doing is looking at the reduced floor for these employers and determining that because we're not getting these contributions in from the employer, this actually shifts to the additional state contribution that we receive through operating appropriation language.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
So we will be required to transfer unrestricted general funds of these two amounts into the retirement, the PERS and TERS fund.
Through the chair to Representative Wilson, this is just for PERS, so it would be an additional state contribution through for PERS, yes.
Thank you.
And Mr. Rooley, does this fiscal note then satisfy the statutory requirement that there has to be an actuarial analysis before going to rule?
Through the chair, yes, sir.
And just for reminding the committee that anything that affects the retirement system requires an actuarial analysis before moving. So, are there further questions for the sponsor? Seeing none at this time, let's go to public testimony. And we have Shanda Huntington and Elena. Are you online? We're here.
This is John Corda, mayor in the city of Galena. Can you hear me okay?
Would you go by again? It was really weak.
Yes, John Corda, mayor for city of Galena.
Okay, yes, we do. John, thanks for introducing yourself. Would you like to give testimony on House Bill 47?
Yeah, please. I'd like to thank the committee for taking time today so that I can explain the importance of HB 47 for communities like Galena that have seen significant population decreases in the last decade. As you may know, the Galena Forward operating location was closed by the United States Air Force. As part of the BRAC process, the Galena FLO closure was effective October 1st, 2010, but had been in process for 4 years. The Air Force was the main source of employment for Galena residents. Not surprisingly, the base closure resulted in a reduction of the population. In 2000, Galena had 675 residents. In 2010, 470 residents, representing a 30% decline. Galena was again struck by hardship in spring of 2013 when ice dammed the Yukon River and inundated the city, leading to a disaster declaration. The 2008 floor established by the current law exists to prevent the municipality from gaming the PERS system by contracting out work previously performed by municipal employees in order to avoid making ongoing contributions to PERS. The current minimum PERS contribution is based on the level of salary that existed in 2008. This purpose does not account for doing the situation. It was not intended, nor does it contemplate, municipalities with sharply declining populations. HB 47 does not change the PERS policy, but rather recognizes nuances. The amendment affects only communities that suffered a minimum 25% decline in population between 2000 and 2010, like Galena. To put that in perspective, the 25% threshold would represent the loss of 75,000 people from Anchorage or 8,000 people from Juneau. What would happen to Fairbanks if the borough's population declined by 30,000 while at the same time seeing the closure of Eielson and Fort Wainwright? The demand for municipal administrative and public services would decline sharply, so would the municipality's ability to provide these services, having lost the region's economic driver. HB 47, which moves the 4 year from 2008 to 2012 for the communities that experience these huge losses, does not provide a loophole allowing Galena or any other community with a similar population loss between 2000 and 2010 to game the system now or in the future. The 2008 floor for these communities is replaced with the 2012 floor. Galena's budgeted payroll for FY 2015 is above the 2012 amount for 17 employees. Galena's circumstances are not a result of any choice the city made. The base closure and loss of close to one-third of the city's population was entirely involuntary. The relationship between the declining population and declining payroll is clear. Fewer residents equal fewer public employees equals lower public payroll. Based on the 2008 floor, Galena is required to pay an amount owed by a city substantially larger than Galena. Galena's required PERS contribution approaches half of the city's entire payroll. Galena's FY 2008 salary total was $1,513,365 for 36 employees. Therefore, Galena's annual minimum PERS contribution is $332,940. In FY 2012, Galena's payroll was $765,776 for 17 employees. That year, this amendment would move the floor to for cities that saw a 25% decrease in population between 2000 and 2010. Under the 2008 floor, Galena's annual minimum PERS contribution is nearly half the city's entire payroll cost. For Galena, the difference in PERS contribution between the 2008 floor and FY 2012 actual payroll is $164,000. This difference will continue going forward, creating an ever-increasing obligation. By statute, any amount unpaid accrues interest at 12%. This ever-increasing obligation adds to an already stressed situation. The city's financial situation was so severe in FY 2011 that it required a low-interest loan through the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank to deal with a severe cash flow crisis that was preventing us from being able to secure fuel for heat and electricity. Simply put, if Galena can't pay its bills, the lights go out in Galena. The 2008 floor is, overall, a sound piece of legislation furthering sound policy, but it does not account for all situations. It does not account for cities that have suffered massive population contractions. This amendment furthers the underlying policy goals of the regulatory structure. It helps ensure that municipalities are able to continue contributing to PERS while recognizing that a city cannot and should not have to make the contribution to the city that has a significantly larger population. Recognizing that Galena is not the same city it was before the base closed and 30% of its population moved away is simply good policy. Policy that helps ensure that Galena continues to contribute to PERS and that the lights stay on. recognizing the reality of sharply declining populations is a worthy amendment and is just plain fair. Thank you for your time. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Korda. We have down Shonda Huntington, the city manager there, as also testifying, but I'm assuming that she is not. Is that correct?
She is here.
I am available, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Are you available just for questions, or did you want to submit testimony as well?
I also have a testimony.
Okay. If you could put yourself on the record as well, your name and affiliation, and proceed.
Okay. My name is Shonda Huntington. I'm the city manager for Galena. Before serving as city manager, I served as a city clerk for 6 years. I was born in Galena. I grew up here, and I raised my children here in Galena. I would like to follow up on Mayor Korda's testimony with information relating to Galena's population decline, the base closure, and the effects on the city, payroll, and finances. As Mayor Korda stated, the Air Force Base officially closed in 2010 following a multi-year drawdown. In 1990, before the base realignment, Galena's population was 847. Galena has always been a small city, and the base was the driver of the economic activity. According to the 2000 census, the number of residents, which does not include all the Air Force personnel, was 675. That number has dropped to 470 with the 2010 census. 205 people may not sound like a lot, but it represents a 30% decrease in the city's resident population between the two censuses. 30% of the residents moved away, but the decline in the city's economic activity was much greater. Without the base, the demand for our city service dropped dramatically. In FY 2008, the current 4-year, Galena's salary total was $1.5 million for 36 employees. Therefore, Galena's annual minimum PERS contribution was over $332,000. In FY 2012, the amended 4-year, Galena's payroll was $765,000 for 17 employees. Between FY 2008 and FY 2012, Galena's payroll was cut in half, reflecting the decrease in population and in economic activity. Galena's current annual minimum PERS contribution of $332,000 is nearly half of the city's FY 2012 total payroll cost. Allowing a 4-year of 2012 for cities that experience a drastic decrease in population changes Galena's annual minimum contribution to $168,000. For Galena, the difference in PERS contribution between 2008 floor and the FY 2012 actual payroll is $164,000. This difference will continue going forward, creating an ever-increasing obligation. By statute, any amount unpaid accrues a compound interest of 12%. This ever-increasing obligation adds to an already stressed situation. The city's financial situation was so severe in FY 2011 that it required a low-interest loan to the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank to deal with severe cash flow crisis that was preventing us from being able to secure fuel for heat and electricity. Simply putting it, if Galena can't pay its bills, the lights go out in Galena. Reasonably adjusting the 4-year for severely impacted cities does not mean that the cities will pay the minimum amount only. Modifying the 4-year changes Galena's minimum annual contribution from $132,000 to $168,000. The actual contributor may be higher. For FY 2013, Galena would, in fact, pay more than the amended minimum. For FY 2013, Galena added one employee for a total payroll of $895,000. For FY 13, Galena's contribute would have been above the 2012 floor by approximately $30,000. HB 47 simply recognizes that the drastic population decrease experienced by some Alaska cities using a clearly defined metric of a 25% decrease in population according to 2000 and 2010 census. The base closure has been very difficult for Galena. As previously noted, Galena required a low-interest loan to the Alaska Bond Bank to secure our fuel for heating and electricity in 2011. In the last several years, Galena's finances have stabilized. There are even indicators of recovery from our drastic decline. We cannot say what will happen to Galena's population in long term, but we believe that we are turning a corner in terms of population and finances. The city of Galena is adjusting to a new reality following the base closure and the loss of 30% of their population. This is just one part of that adjustment. I became a city manager in a difficult period for the city. Our finances have stabilized somewhat over the last years, requiring the city of Galena to pay current contribution owned by much larger city weakness, Galena, and threatening its ability to prove any contribution to PERS. We are optimistic that the city will become stronger, even grow over time. If and when Galena becomes that city as it was in 2008, the city will be required to make PERS contributions to what their size of their payroll, and will gladly do so. But it's not that city right now, and the oversized PERS contribution inhibits it from becoming so. Recognizing the reality of the drastic declining population is a matter of simple fairness. The amendment recognizes this and ultimately promotes the goal of PERS, ensuring that Alaska continues to contribute their fair share to the system. I would like to thank the committee for taking time so that I may explain the importance of this amendment for the communities like Galena that have been significantly population decreased in the last decade.
Thank you, Ms. Huntington. Are there any questions for Mr. Korda or Ms. Huntington of the committee? Seeing no questions, we do have also here in the room for a public testimony, Kathy Wasserman. Are you here? If you could put yourself, your name on the record as well as your affiliation and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kathy Wasserman, Executive Director of the Alaska Municipal League. We've been working on this bill for some years in order to continue to address mainly the payments that municipalities pay on the PERS back liability. And this particular situation came to our attention probably 4 to 5 years ago, and mainly with Galena. I'm going to double dip here a bit. As the former mayor of Pelican, I'm very familiar with this issue. So Pelican had a cold storage plant owned by a Japanese firm that they then sold to a local, a state tribal organization who came into town, purchased the cold storage, and then they declared bankruptcy. So not only did we lose a good number of our population, but many of the spouses of the fishermen involved with Cake Tribal worked for the city, a very small number, but they left. So our 2008 floor just crumpled and it went way down, and that's suddenly why we got saddled with these charges. At 12% interest, and especially with cuts in revenue sharing and cost transfers, at some point some of these very small communities, which are the ones that get hurt by this kind of legislation, cannot ever dig themselves out. It may increase the liability to the state, but without that scenario, these bills will just continue to build. 12% interest is a bit high, I would think, and this is sort of like a community maybe willingly going to one of these loan shops and asking for an advance on their paycheck, which we're always told not to do, and certainly that's sort of the situation that some of these communities get into. So due to those situations, AML is totally in favor of House Bill 47, and we certainly hope that it moves through and gives these small communities an opportunity to catch back up with themselves. No payments will come in if these communities do not prosper in some way. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Wasserman. Are there any questions of the committee? Mr. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Ms. Wasserman, for being here and what you do for the AML. There's been a lot of things said in this room over the past few years when asked about the PERS liability, and I keep going back to Mike Lamb and who was instrumental in the settlement agreement. And I ask him if there's any way that you could extract what a community actually owes. And he says, absolutely not. There is no way, no matter what anybody says, the ability to extract what any single community or any single employee owes into this system from this process. So, I mean, from the liability. So my question is the threshold, the 22% threshold, we don't know if they're actually paying, if they've been overpaying or underpaying. They've just been paying by the formula. And is that an accurate assessment?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, certainly I guess I've had to live and breathe PERS for a number of years. As far as being a financial wizard, you can probably ask Ms. Lee and Mr. Worley. I am not. But that is my understanding, that 22%, and I was exec of AML at the time, was a number that we agreed upon with the Senate Finance at the time. In fact, I think the number we put forth at first was 15-16%. Senate wanted 24%, and we settled on 22. And at the time, no one really knew. Some communities probably are overpaying, some are underpaying, but we're all committed to paying. So that's basically what I understand. So I would say yes. As far as I understand, that's pretty correct.
So if I may, Mr. Chair, follow through.
Follow up.
So really the purpose of this bill is not to make sure that somebody pays up what they owe, because that's really not possible, according to many people, but simply so that they could keep paying something they could afford by bringing it back to the 2008 level.
And Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, this simply moves the floor and adjusts the interest. So they still owe the principal of their past cost. Adjusted a bit for the floor, but this does not give them relief from paying back. And in the situation of Galena, and I believe Pelican, I think they're current with their current payments. It's just this is the past liability that they're not current with.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Do we have any further questions of the committee?
Yeah.
Representative Pruitt.
Yeah. Thank you, Kathy. I appreciate your insight when you come in. One question I've got to trying to understand is, of course, well, first, do you foresee, I mean, obviously this is a fix put forward for a small number of communities. Do you foresee some communities coming in the near future? In near future could be 5 years, 10 years, but in the future, recognizing now that we've made certain slight adjustments, that they might, we could see others coming to us asking for some slight adjustments in a similar manner?
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, I really don't, because first of all, even though they're not growing to a huge amount, wages continue to grow somewhat. I mean, a person will no longer work for $8 an hour, even though maybe they did a couple of years ago. And so I think as time goes on, that whole floor issue will perhaps go away. So I don't see this as affecting too many people, because it's going to be harder and harder on out years to go as low as you were in 2008. I mean, with your own budget issues here in the state, I mean, you know, you can go back a certain amount and say, okay, we're holding steady with 213 or 212, but you go back too much farther and it gets very difficult because of just the way the, you know, inflation has taken place.
Yeah, thank you. And follow up.
Follow up?
Yeah, I appreciate that. And then the other question that I have is obviously you've come in other situations, definitely a lot of concern from the municipalities on the legislature potentially pushing stuff onto the municipalities. You know, of course, the challenge here is municipalities coming in and asking us to take take some of the burden. And of course, trying to balance the taking, you know, and dealing with what we need to, and not trying to place an additional burden on a small community with the changes that have gone in there, but also recognizing the other challenge that we're, of trying to limit any sort of kind of pass through to those communities. How do the rest? I mean, we're talking about a small. Do the rest of your membership? Are they comfortable? Are they okay with, okay, you guys can go ahead and take care of that small group, recognizing that I know it's a small amount. I know we're not talking in comparison to the large scope, but eventually this they could see some of this fall on them at some point in time.
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, you know, those are all very real concerns. I think most of the membership, I mean, I know all of our membership realizes that this bill is in there, and I think they all pretty well come to the defense of a community that says, we're at the end of our rope, we can't do anymore. However, every municipality in the state, without exception, that is a PERS member, are still also waiting for us to help solve the termination studies and the PERS floor, which is the bigger issue. This is kind of a Band-Aid. This is not a fix. This is a Band-Aid for those communities that are bleeding so heavily. We've got to stop it. The bigger fix we're still working on.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And Mr. Chair, she brings up a good point about the termination studies. I think that's been brought up by our current newer members from the Anchorage Assembly have brought that up several times as something. And this might be an avenue to address that concern as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any further questions of the committee? Seeing no questions, thank you, Ms. Wasserman.
Thank you.
And is there anybody else in the room or online that would like to testify? Seeing none, we will close public testimony, and we will set HB 47 aside. And if members have amendments for this bill, please have them turned in to my staff, Jane Pearson, by 5 p.m. Monday, April 10th. And with that, we'll move on to our next bill, which is HB 131. It's the Relocation Assistance for Fed Projects and Programs. And here to introduce that is Representative Adam Wohl's staff, Laura Steidolf. And if you could, put yourself on the record and proceed with your presentation.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the House Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Laura Steidolf, and I'm staff to the House Transportation Committee. In front of you is House Bill 131, the Federal Relocation Assistance Program Projects Bill, which will bring Alaska into compliance with federal law concerning reimbursement for relocation expenses incurred by individuals or businesses that were displaced due to a federally funded highway, bridge, or facilities project. Alaskans deserve to be fairly compensated in these circumstances. HB 131 will also protect Alaska's $500-plus million annual allocation of Federal Highway Administration funding by bringing the state into compliance. In 2012, Congress relaxed the eligibility criteria and increased the maximum reimbursement limits for the state's relocation assistance programs when they passed their transportation authorization and funding bill, the Moving Ahead for Progress into the 21st Century, also known as MAP 21. Prior to MAP 21, the payment rates hadn't changed for 30 years. These changes went into effect October 1st, 2014. Unfortunately, Alaska statute continues to reflect the more stringent eligibility requirements and the smaller maximum reimbursement limits. During the second half of the 29th Alaska legislature, this inconsistency between state and federal law was nearly fixed. Language similar to HB 131 was proposed and passed in the House unanimously. It passed through the Senate State Affairs and Senate Finance. However, the bill was held in Senate rules where it was never calendared for a Senate floor vote. HB 131 assures Alaskans that their legislature wants them to be compensated the same as a resident of any other state. Thanks for the opportunity to present this bill on behalf of the House Transportation Committee. Heather Fair, the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities statewide right-of-way chief, is also here if you have any other questions.
Thank you. Do we have any questions for Ms. Steidolf or Ms. Fair? Representative Wilson. They both start with W.
I just answer to just about anything, but thank you. So I remember voting on this last year. But the question I have, because we're dealing with a gentleman on University Avenue, a veteran who this would affect, but is there anything in the federal that also talks about compensating for the property we're taking, not just for relocation?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, this bill only deals with relocation expenses.
Follow up? I understand that, but, you know, when you open up a bill, we always want to find out if there's something else we can help with. And I was just curious, was it just under the federal regulations that this falls under, does any of that also talk about any minimums or what for actual property that's being, for the same rules, for a federal program, is that addressed in the same type of area, or is it addressed underneath something completely different?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, I do believe it's addressed under Map 21, and I know that our office was familiar with that case. I'll defer to Heather Fair on the specifics for that, though.
Thank you.
Ms. Fair?
Good afternoon. For the record, Heather Fair, statewide right-of-way chief for the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. Representative Wilson, through the chair, your question with regard to whether or not this bill addresses in the same general area of statutes, I understand, for acquisition of property aside from relocation, is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, whether the federal government does, because we're fixing an issue with the federal government on this, does the federal government have something that also deals with fair market value and treating our citizens right on federal programs and reimbursing them or paying for their property at a fair market value?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, yes, the federal government sets those guidelines under what's called briefly the Uniform Act, and Map 21 that was referenced earlier updated that, but only specific to relocation. So yes, there are federal requirements that we meet and we match in state statute to compensate for the acquisition of the property separate from relocation.
Can I follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow up.
And are we in compliance with the federal government on that portion?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, we are compliant.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any further questions?
Sure.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Ms. Fair, just because I'm going to have to go through the fiscal note and I've looked at it, the cost of this will be absorbed when we fund capital projects, but that if there's an if the compensation rate is higher than it is right now, then that'll be some money. We don't know what, because we don't know what capital projects this will affect. So will it be a higher compensation rate, which I'm fine with, and shouldn't the fiscal note then be indeterminate?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, that's a very good point. As you know, we design our projects iteratively to minimize impact on Alaskan families, businesses, and farms. And as a result, it is difficult, if not impossible, to understand what that fiscal impact to the state would be. But as a matter of course, it's approximately 9% average state contribution on federal projects to their 91% contribution. So we ran some numbers on what we could estimate so far on known projects, and it came out to about $12,000 state share on the known projects over the next 3 years. So it's quite minimal.
Thank you. Yeah, the expensive one was the Kinnick Arm Bridge, but I won't go there. So,
yeah. Do we have any further questions of the committee?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pruitt?
Yeah, in the same vein on the fiscal note, I recognize going forward, but this is retroactive back to 2014. Is there, can you speak to the fiscal aspect of going retroactive on this? Is there federal, will it come from federal money in future years to go back and pay for that, or is there money just that's waiting for us to draw from, as well as then the state's impact? I know it's 9%, but we should have an idea of 2014 and now.
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, we did look retroactively, and again, the state contribution is less than a few thousand dollars. I'm unclear whether or not that money has been set aside waiting payment or has already been paid. Right now, our state statutes are out of compliance with Map 21, so we are not allowed to make those payments and comply with state law at the same time.
Okay. I think
thank you. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To what extent does this bill fix a potential problem in the future? And it was kind of what the representative before me was asking about. Do we have a significant amount of people in the past who haven't been had access to any of these benefits had they been relocated?
Representative Ortiz, through the chair, no. I think we have less than a dozen people that may have been impacted. But, of course, that number could rise the longer this bill takes to approve.
Any further questions? Representative Garrett.
Ms. Fair, thank you, through the chair. Maybe there is no fiscal impact. So does this change the compensation rate or the pool of people who – or increase the pool of people who will be compensated?
Representative Garrett, through the chair, it does change eligibility somewhat. Federal government relaxed those requirements a little bit so that more people could be eligible. But from the projects that we have had to date, there aren't a significant new number of people that would qualify for relocation benefits in amounts greater than they've already been compensated.
Right. Thanks.
Representative Wilson.
But a follow-up on Representative Garrett is, but we will owe them more money, so that's where the fiscal impact is if we're going to retroact. Because we want to be in compliance with the federal law, not ours, we will owe money from the past, even though it's a few thousand dollars. There still is a fiscal impact because we have to make that up.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, that's correct. Again, it's not clear, though, whether or not we've already made those payments out of state funds and then look for reimbursement later from the federal government or for holding those payments. I believe it's the former, but we haven't been able to determine that because it was so few people affected so far.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I should have mentioned this earlier, if you could just state your name prior, since we have two female voices and we've got transcription. Representative Kawasaki.
Thanks. Just to challenge the zero fiscal note too, like the rest of the members here. In the Q&A memo that's listed, it talks about increasing the maximum reestablishment expense payments. It's a little bit over double. Increasing the maximum amount of fixed payments is double. Increasing the maximum purchase price differential for owners is, 50% higher. Increasing the maximum, it seems like a lot. And so when we say that we're going to be picking up the tab on 10% of 100% or roughly 10%, it seems like that could amount to a lot of dollars in the future if we go to the maximum. So I'm just challenging the zero fiscal note, and if you can give me any more clarity. You mentioned earlier, I think $12,000 was for existing projects. Can you talk to the potential for projects in the future? I think if a person knew that they were going to be moved or could be reestablished, they'd probably try to request the highest amount possible. So, thanks.
Heather Fair for DOT. Representative Kawasaki through the chair. The reimbursements are based on actual expenses, and so it is true that if we had a project that had high impacts that we weren't able to design around impacting farms, businesses, and families, that we could see a more fiscal impact to the state in terms of our share, our 9% share. Although it is impossible to know that at this point, even with projects that are 3 to 5 years out, because we're still designing those projects. So, again, trying to minimize that impact.
Any further questions of the committee? Seeing no questions, we will open up HB 131 to public testimony. And just as a reminder, folks can submit written testimony to House Finance at akleg.gov, and House Finance has no spaces. And with that, do we have anyone in the room who would like to testify? Seeing none, do we have anybody online? Nobody's online. Okay, with that, we will close public testimony on HB 131. And any further comments from the committee? Seeing none, we'll set aside HB 131. And if folks could please get amendments into my office by 5 p.m. on Monday, April 10th, 2017, to my aide, Jane Pearson. And with that, we'll move on to HB 127, which is the criminal conviction overturned bill by Representative Kawasaki. And are you going to be coming to the table, Representative? Okay, and then also your aide, Olivia Garrett. if you could both put yourself on the record and proceed, and just also available to answer questions in the room are Jerry Burnett, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Revenue. Casey Schroeder might be online from the Department of Law, Criminal Division, and Hillary Martin from Legislative Legal Services. She's online. And with that, please proceed. We have a question from Representative Wilson.
What are we going to ask? What are you going to present first? I'll wait till. Well, let me put it out there. Let me just. Because, you know, I've looked at this bill and I'm really concerned because I'm not sure it does what we think it does. So please help me understand. So on the bill itself, on page 1, line 10, when it talks about if the individual conviction is vacated or reversed, and I'm pretty sure I know we're probably not supposed to talk about specifics, but we know what specific people. I'm pretty sure it was vacated, their judgment, but where I'm not sure about, but then it has to fit the charges on which the conviction was based are later dismissed. I'm pretty sure that the charges weren't dismissed, or the individual is retried and found not guilty, and that was not done either. So if I had a conviction that was just vacated, and one of these other two things didn't happen, I would not be eligible underneath this bill. Is that not correct?
So, through the chair, Representative Wilson, I did want to state, you know, on the record that I know that there's obviously the high-profile case in Fairbanks, and every member of this legislature recognizes that. This bill wasn't specifically meant to address the Fairbanks 4. This bill was meant to address any wrongfully convicted, incarcerated individual within state custody who has been denied the ability to receive a permanent fund dividend. And it speaks to a much higher level change that I believe I would like to see, and I think other members of this legislature would like to see. On the specifics to the case, I'd like to defer that to the Department of Law, and they are here. We also have I'm not sure if it's in backup packets, but we also do have a copy of the agreement that was signed between Attorney General Craig Richards and the individuals, which you know as the Fairbanks Four.
And Mr. Chairman, I know it's not just about that, but they testified yesterday, and I just want to make sure that I'm reading it correctly, because the way I read it, they would not be eligible with this bill, because although it was, by my understanding, it was vacated, the charges were not dismissed, and they were not retried and found not guilty. So since they were the ones that testified yesterday on behalf of the bill, because they felt that they were going to be eligible, I just want to make sure that I am interpreting this correctly. So I think you said Ms. Schroeder was online?
Ms. Schroeder, I do not believe, is online. I don't see her on my iPad, and I don't see her in the room. Correct, Department of Law. Somebody else here for the Department of Law? We don't believe that there's anybody available from the Department of Law.
I've got some questions
for you. Okay.
Did she say she's here?
Ledge Legal.
Yeah, we do have Ledge Legal. I don't know if Hillary Martin, I don't know if you're able to answer that.
Yeah, this is Hillary Martin, Ledge Legal Services. Representative Wilson, through the chair, you are correct in how you're reading the bill. However, I don't actually know the disposition of that particular case, so I can't answer whether this bill would apply to that situation or not.
And we do have Casey Schroeder, who just stepped in. Casey, can you come to the... And if you could repeat the question...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I don't want to get into the specifics of any case. This is just the outcome. So what we're talking about is a bill on page 1, line 10, where it talks about the individual's conviction is vacated or reversed. It's my understanding the Fairbanks 4 was vacated. And I could be wrong about this, so I'm just trying to clarify. But if that's true that it was vacated or reversed, either one, then they would have to fall under the chart. Then they would have to have that and... One, the charges on which the conviction was based are later dismissed. I'm pretty sure that it wasn't dismissed. Or the individual is retried and found not guilty, and they were not retried and found not guilty. So in that particular case, just by the outcome, would they fall eligible underneath this bill?
For the record, Casey Schroeder, Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division at the Department of Law. Through the chair, Representative Wilson, those cases would fall under this bill under the convictions were vacated and then the underlying charges were dismissed.
Follow up. So all the charges that they originally went to jail for were dismissed?
Through the chair to Representative Wilson, that is correct.
Thank you. I was not aware of that. Thank you.
Do we have any further questions, Representative Thompson?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I had questions along the same lines because I couldn't figure out vacated. Was their conviction vacated? Was their sentence vacated? And does vacation mean that it's overturned, dismissed, or reversed? That's where I got confused with this vacated definition and which one was what and what does it mean?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, in that particular case, all the judgments in those cases were vacated. So the conviction as well as the sentence and the restitution orders were vacated. And so that basically vacated and reversed means the same thing. It means to annul. You will often see trial courts use the word vacate when they're vacating judgments, their own judgments, and you'll often see appellate courts use the word reversed. But it means the same thing. They both mean to annul. And that's not a hard and fast rule. The words mean the same. They are used interchangeably.
Thank you, Ms. Schroeder.
Representative Guttenberg and then Pruitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not being a grammar, somebody well-versed in grammar. So on line 10, after the word reversed, that comma, is that what's commonly referred to as an Oxford comma? Is that situation we're looking at?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, I believe it is an Oxford comma, yes.
Okay. So it's a separates the clauses.
It does.
Okay.
Representative Pruitt and Mingera.
Fascinated with some of the questions we come up with sometimes. Ms. Schroeder, I appreciate it. Ms. Schroeder, can you tell me, obviously there's the four that's the focus, but this is an impact beyond the four individuals. How many people are we potentially talking about that might be able to go back and utilize this for receiving their permit funds?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, that is a common question, and unfortunately this session our database has not allowed us to pull that kind of information, but I know that the court system has pulled information, and you are correct, it is beyond the four, but I think the sponsor has the exact numbers.
Give me a sec.
While he's looking, can I ask one other question?
Your follow-up?
So recognizing that this actually, if I've gathered, this can go back to 82, honestly. There's no limitation on that. Does this, and I don't know the exact terminology, which is why I asked. Let's use, for example, a situation back before, and I wasn't here, 2004, somewhere in that time frame, our governors had the ability to also pardon people. We, of course, have removed that authority in the same capacity. Can individuals who might have been pardoned by a governor in decades past be able to come back and request that their PFDs that they may not have received, that they receive those?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, the bill does not speak to pardons, so they may not be able to use provisions of the bill, but I don't know how the Department of Revenue has viewed pardons in the past, so that might be a question for them.
Thank you. And through the chair, Representative Pruitt, it is difficult to find the information because, as Department of Law said, they don't track that data. The courts did, however, come up with some numbers when it came to a similar piece of legislation that was introduced in the 29th legislature. Out of the total that they found, there were two in 2011 that could potentially qualify, two in 2012, zero in 2013, two in 2014. There were two cases that were pending at the time of the study, and 13 in 2015, and that included all of the Fairbanks 4 and two cases pending. That total would account for 19 to 23 individuals between the years 2011 and 2015.
Follow up. Okay, so and I just want to make sure I understand the bill. But we're not just talking about from 2011 to today. We are talking about, I believe we can go back to 82 because it's specifically referring to permanent fund dividends. How many total? And that's less of a question really about how many, but really how much are we talking about? Because if someone back in 82 and or well back in 83 and 84 didn't get it, you know, that's $300 and whatever it was the next year, as opposed to you look at the, you know, 2000s and you're somewhere in the 1900 1800 range. Do we have an idea going back that far? And lastly, and I don't see it here, I want to make sure I understand, there's not an interest aspect to this discussion, is that, and please, you know, put that on record to answer that one.
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, to answer your last question first, there is no interest payments involved. The Department of Revenue, the Commissioner's Office, shall determine the value of the permanent fund for each of those dividend years in which the person were wanting to apply. The Department of Law would then decide which folks for which years would be eligible for those, and they would have an application period of 120 days after this piece of legislation were signed into law. And if they didn't sign up within the 120 day period, they would be ineligible at that time.
And final follow-up. I don't want to make the assumption, but I'm assuming that for the past ones, not the one, of course, obviously the ones going forward, that there would just be an appropriation that would come out of, or well, maybe not even appropriation, but just basically this would come out of the earnings reserve. Is that understanding of where that, how that would be handled?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, there is somebody from the Permanent Fund Division that can answer very technical questions as well as Department of Revenue. Basically, I'll just say that the money comes from what's called the Reserve for Prior Year Dividend Liabilities. That is a calculated number. Many of you guys, members here, would recognize when somebody calls your office and says, I forgot to apply, or I did this, something's wrong, or you know, my college kid wrote the wrong thing down and said they weren't going to come back, but they really are living in Alaska. Lots of circumstances. So there is a specific reserve that is applied. Department of Revenue keeps that in reserves to pay those types of permanent fund dividends. That's where the money would come from, and that's why there's a resulting zero fiscal note.
And actually, one more question. I came out
your
of
follow-up?
Recognizing, you know, obviously for those that are in prison that do not apply, you know, there's they're not allowed to. We essentially apply for them. I mean, we don't, but we calculate that and determine that we're going to utilize that money in a different capacity. You don't see any complication that would arise from the fact that essentially mm-hmm. their permanent funds, any of them, any person out there, we've already spent their permanent funds, whether it was on mm-hmm. health care costs or for victims. Victims' compensation. There's not going to be any conflict that looks back and says, "All right, the money has already been spent. We're just making a policy call that we'll go ahead and take it out of that particular account and go ahead and pay for it going forward." Is am I kind of in the right vein?
I through the chair, Representative Pruitt. I think it's definitely a policy call. What I will say is that when a person goes to jail, finds themselves in prison, they were wrongfully convicted and then released, they are also victims. And so this bill addresses that aspect. And that's why I aim to pass this piece of legislation, is for them.
And Mr. Chair?
Hello?
I'm not discussing that particular piece. I'm just trying to understand the other situations that could come, making sure that we've covered, and there's not other ramifications, you know, kind of the ancillary effects of the decisions that we make here in terms of the actual fiscal. I completely agree. If someone is inappropriately placed in prison, we have disrupted their lives, and I'm not going to argue against that. I agree that there is this is kind of a small thing. I'm just trying to look at the ancillary effects and making sure there is not something that would come back and say, you've already spent that money and somehow we have to go back and make some sort of switch in some sort of weird fund, that this just surely is going to be, we're expending money going forward. We aren't going to account that money was used in another capacity.
So through the chair, Representative Pruitt, again, I think that it's certainly a policy call. I believe that when a person is put in jail for and is wrongfully convicted, that we owe them something for the fact that they sat in jail and the fact that they were denied the benefit of even applying for a permanent fund dividend, and that money was essentially transferred over. The Department of Revenue will be able to explain the mechanism by which they take the permanent fund dividend, and that goes into the compensation, Violent Crimes Compensation Board, into the Department of Corrections. They'll be able to explain the details of that. But that's, you know, I think that's a policy call. But again, I think that we owe those victims who were wrongfully incarcerated that privilege.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, can we get Jerry up? Because I'm looking for an answer.
Sure, Mr. Jerry Burnett, if you could come up and put your name and affiliation on the record.
Yeah, for the record, this is Jerry Burnett. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Revenue. And there are a couple of things that I could address quickly, and then maybe I could ask Representative Pruitt to repeat his specific question. One of the things he brought up was this going back to 1982, and from 1982 until the mid-90s, and I don't remember exactly what year it was, you were eligible for a permanent fund dividend even if you were incarcerated. So you don't go back to 1982. You go back to some time in the 1990s, which I think is an important thing. The money will be paid out of the reserve for prior year dividends, which we calculate every year on a statistical basis. And so the number of people that have been identified by the courts in last year and this, and the number that's been discussed here is not significant relative to the amount of money that we reserve each year, because we get people who are, you know, between 0 and 18 years old whose parents don't apply maybe for their full 18 years, and then they apply when they're between 18 and 20. We get people whose appeals are upheld, you know, by the Office of Administrative Hearings, by the Commissioner's Office, or by the courts. And so between all of those things, this number of people is insignificant relative to our total number of appeals.
No, I don't think it's a follow-up. Thank you, Jerry. I appreciate it. I wanted to set the policy aside and ask about the fiscal ramifications and how it associated. You answered the questions. Thanks for coming up.
Do we have any further questions of the committee? Representative Guerra.
Thank you. This is really for the sponsor, and in my view, the sponsor knows more about the bill than I do. But it seems to me that if you're wrongfully convicted, you're going to get out of jail. You're going to spend your time trying to lead your life again, right? And there are going to be many, many more important things than your dividend. You're not going to think about that right away. There's nothing in here that I see that requires anybody notify a released prisoner who is wrongfully convicted that, hey, by the way, you also get your dividend back. So, and whether or not you want to put in a requirement of some sort of notice later on, that's certainly your call. But I wonder about the limit of saying you have to ask for it within 120 days. So we're talking about the same number of people. Let's say it's 40 people. It's the Fairbanks Four, and then let's just say it's 40 people for argument's sake. Those are the people who we owe the dividend back to. I wouldn't really want to cut somebody off because they had 120 days worth of much more important stuff to deal with in their lives than remembering to apply for their dividend. Everybody else gets a year. It's just an off-the-cuff thought. I don't know whether you have an opinion on whether we should give people a year or whether 120 days seems like the right amount of time.
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, there was a discussion in a former committee that 120 days seemed like a short period of time in which a person can adjust to life outside of prison. We respected the will of the committee at the time that did not want to offer an amendment to change that time frame from 120 days to a longer period, but it's the will of this committee now.
Representative Kerr?
Yeah, through the chair, a delicate thing with the bill is you don't want to you have your own principles. You don't want to violate somebody else's principles. So, and then all of a sudden cause a bill that needs to move. So, I think since you're on the committee, I think I'll let you assess whether or not that would violate the principles of other people in the building. So.
Any further questions of the committee? Seeing no questions, we will go ahead and set this bill aside, HB 127. And if folks do have amendments, if they could get them to my office and to my aide, Jane Pearson, by 5 p.m. on Monday, April 10th, 2017. And so the final bill we have before us today is under bills previously heard is HB 141, which is the Alaska Workforce Investments Board and Funds by Representative Fansler and Mary Schlosser, his staff. If you could go ahead and put yourselves on the record. And just FYI, we do also have Debbie Banizak, a Special Assistant from the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, Paloma Harbor, Director of Administrative Services for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, and they're available to answer any questions. So with that, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the record, my name is Zach Fansler. My name is Zach Fansler, and I am the proud representative of District 38, Bethel, and Lower Kuskokwim, Yukon Delta.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mary Bobzuk Schlosser, staff to Representative Fansler.
Just as a reminder, this is our second time that we're talking about HB 141. HB 141 is a funding mechanism for technical and vocational education programs. This is a program that has been in place now for quite some time. It's currently set to sunset and end on June 30th, 2017. This is a straight-up five-year renewal. That would put the same distribution in place that's always been in place and extend it through June 30th of 2022. The last time we were here, there were several excellent questions by representatives, and we did provide, and hopefully everybody received the memo, hopefully addressing the questions that were asked, and we're more than willing to go over that or to answer further questions or get further into the bill if anyone wishes us to do that.
Representative Wilson.
Mr. Chairman, so I just have one question. So since this is coming from unemployment money and it's not coming from general funds, if a private school wanted to be considered, would that be in any kind of violation of our Constitution?
That's an excellent question through the chair. Thank you, Representative Wilson, for that question. I am not a constitutional scholar, so I will hopefully defer to perhaps we have Ledge Legal on the line or someone that can answer that better than I can.
So let's see here. We've got Paloma Harbor. Who else did I say was here? Debbie Banizak, Special Assistant from the Department of Labor. We don't have anybody from law here. Casey Schroeder was here a second ago. Paloma Harbor, she might have something to add.
Perhaps Ms. Harbor can answer that question if she can come forward.
For the record, Paloma Harbor, Administrative Services Division Director for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I think in the first letter that Representative Fansler's office provided to you, it talked about what the requirements are and are not about around this fund. Just the fact that it's coming from employee contributions to the unemployment insurance, there's no federal requirements on that, so we know that much. The state requirements are what are put in statute by the legislature, so I'm not aware of any constitutional problems. But again, I'm not a constitutional expert either.
Representative Wilson?
So that would also be any religious schools, any other kind of schools. They would just have to meet the requirements of what type of, just by the statute, whether or not they would be able to be included.
You know, through the chair, Representative Wilson, I'm not sure. I don't know what the requirements are on separations and things like that. But that's my understanding, is that whomever you put in statute would be an eligible recipient.
And Mr. Chairman, the reason I'm asked the question, I know that there are stipulations for putting general funds into certain types of schools. But since this is unemployment funding, which is quite a bit different than state funding, it was my understanding, I just wanted to have it verified, that they wouldn't have the same requirements because it's unemployment money. It's about training students, not by what type of school it is.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, it becomes state funds the moment you put it in the designated account, the technical and vocational education program. That's a designated state general fund account. So,
thank you.
Thank you, Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Ms. Harbor or Representative Hansler, my understanding is this bill will cover right now the same training centers that are covered this current year. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, that is correct. It's 10 institutions that would receive the exact same amount of money that they received in the past for the last, I think the previous one was a three-year sunset that they had put in. This one would now extend that for five more years.
And the constitutional question is we've had it before. Representative Wilson is right. So it's the Constitution says private funds cannot be used for public education. My guess is that if there have been private institutions funded by TVEP, either nobody's challenged it, we don't know the answer, whether that counts as public education, whether public education is K through 12. But these are the same entities that we've been funding, so I guess I'm not that concerned. And just as we've done in the past, if somebody has crossed the line, then I'm sure somebody will say something about it. But I'm not concerned at this point.
Any further questions of the committee? Seeing no further questions, Representative Guerra, if you could read the fiscal notes into the record.
It's a lot of them.
Five of them. Yeah.
That's why you've got the
job. Can I just say same as last year? Is that?
It's not the same as last year.
I am looking at the wrong bill. I was going to read Representative Kawasaki's fiscal note. Yeah. All right. Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The fiscal notes for House Bill 141. The first one is OMB component 2276. That is for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, Employment Training Services, Unemployment Insurance, and that is a fiscal note of $408,000, $408,900, all the same source of funding that we've discussed, designated general funds. For the same department, but the allocation of workforce development, we have OMB component 3117. Again, to extend the sunset of this program, it'll be the same source of designated general funds for $4,210,100. One day I will ask somebody to write the numbers out. But third fiscal note, OMB component 2686 for the Alaska Vocational Technical Center, which will receive funds under this bill, $2,034,000. Those are also the same source of designated general funds. OMB component 1296, that's for the University of Alaska, which will receive some of these funds, and same source of designated general funds, $5,386,600. And the final fiscal note is fiscal note number 2796, Department of Education and Early Development, Teaching and Learning Support, School and Student Achievement, and that is $478,800. Same source of funding we've been talking about, designated general funds.
Okay, are there any questions on the fiscal notes? Okay, seeing no questions, Representative Seaton, can I have a motion to move HB 141, version A, from the House Finance Committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move House Bill 141, version 30LS0551/A from committee with individual recommendation and attach five fiscal notes.
Are there any objections? Seeing no objections, HB 141, version A, is reported out from the House Finance Committee. And after I announce tomorrow's meeting, we will... folks can stick around to sign the committee report. So with that, our next meeting is scheduled for tomorrow, Friday, April 7th at 1:30 p.m. And at this meeting, we will hear HB 111, which is the oil and gas production tax and credits bill. And it's possible the bill will be on basis tonight. If not, then tomorrow morning. And amendments for this bill will be due on Saturday, April 8th at 10 a.m. And with that, the time is currently 2:57 p.m., and we are recessed to a call of the chair. We'll likely reconvene sometime tomorrow after amendments are submitted. And with that, thank you.